And welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. We're also on iTunes at College Radio. And today is Wednesday, February 9th, 2012. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And my guests today are Kaija Parsonen and Eric Weiner. First up is Kaija Parsonen. She was born in Saudi Arabia and lived there for 12 years as a third-generation expatriate. When her family left the kingdom, they moved to hill country of central Texas. She earned a degree in English literature from Princeton and received her MFA from the Iowa Writers Workshop, where she held a Truman Capote Fellowship and a Teaching and Writing Fellowship. For The Ruins of Us, her first novel, she received a Michener Copernicus Award. She lives with her husband on the edge of a quarry in Columbia, Missouri. Hi, Kaija.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Great to have you. Talk about the genesis of your book, of The Ruins of Us, how it came about.
Sure. I think it came about in a rather haphazard way, as many first novels do. It really originated in the feeling of nostalgia that I had for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which was where I was born and lived until I was 12, and where my mother had also grown up. And so she and I shared this sort of longing for the country of our childhood. And as I grew older and started to learn more about the culture and the country itself and start to research a little bit more about this place I had come from and at one point considered myself to be from, I just started wanting to learn more and more and understand more because the complexities were so fascinating to me. So really this book was an attempt to hang on to this place that I had left as a child. And, you know, once you leave the kingdom, you really can't venture back. They take your visa, and unless you have an immediate family member there, you can't return. So I really wrote this book as an attempt to venture back to the country and also to understand it better in a way that I never had as a child living on a compound, fairly isolated from the rest of the culture.
That's interesting because, like you said, it's you can't return. Well, literally you can't return, but also I think when you leave somewhere that you grew up, it becomes sort of mythic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I really liked how you showed the clash and merging of cultures. That really interested me. Your main characters, Abdullah and Rosalie, they meet in the States as students, and she returns with him to Saudi and adapts to his way of life. And then their children, their teens, are Western, very much Western. I was so curious as I was reading. I'm always curious how much of fiction writers bring into it from their own life. And I'm curious if you knew anybody like this, anyone who took a second wife, who started out being sort of Western and in maybe their native environment and then ended up adapting some of their cultural habits.
Mm-hmm. Well, the practice of taking multiple wives and practicing plural marriage does occur in modern-day Saudi Arabia. Even King Abdullah has four wives. And as far as a personal connection to this narrative, we had a family friend with whom my parents had attended college, actually at University of Southern California. And they had been close friends of his for decades, and also of his wife, who was American and who had hung around with them in California in their college days. And one day my mother got a call from the wife, and this was when I was about 14 or 15 years old, and she was crying. She was just devastated. She'd learned that her husband had been married to another woman for 15 years, actually. And so as a teenager, I really could not grasp that concept of, you know, having a second wife. And also I was a nascent feminist, and so it just disturbed me on multiple levels. And I knew this family. I knew their children. They had a daughter around my age, and I just kept wondering, you know, how she was reacting to it and how it affected their family life. I became a little obsessed with the logistics of it, particularly as I grew older. And so that also contributed to the birth of the novel, where I just wanted to work out some of those questions that I had been asking myself about this family that I knew.
Mm, yeah, that's interesting. But all those years, and she had no idea?
That's right. And, you know, her sons knew. It was sort of a male family secret. And, yeah, she just, and I don't even think it was willful ignorance. I just think it's possible that, you know, when they're living in two separate houses, often in two separate cities, and if the husband is traveling quite frequently for business, that it just, it's possible to live this dual life, which, you know, I'm always fascinated by the concept of, you know, dual identities. And, mm-hmm. and so, again, that sort of fed my obsession with this particular story.
Well, that's interesting, actually, because before I came along, when my father married my mother, he had an entirely separate family that he was still married to his first wife. And my brother was a baby. I think they'd been together a couple years when my mother got a phone call from some mysterious person that said, you know, your husband has another family.
Wow.
She thought he'd been going away on business, you know.
Oh, my God.
Sort of a similar thing.
It's hardly particular to Saudi Arabia, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yes, it's also sort of common, I think, in the Italian culture, from the Italy, you know, Italian culture. And
Very interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah, I just thought you really explored the complexities of emotion of such a situation. One of the scenes I found especially poignant, and I don't think we're going to give anything away here, in me talking about this, is when Abdullah imagines the far off future when both of his wives will be old.
Mm-hmm.
That was really interesting.
And it sort of makes him panic.
Yeah.
He's a little bit angry that, you know, Isra, this woman he's married for her beauty, and she's a bit younger than Rosalie, will one day also be old.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe perhaps he'll have to take care of her even. And I think he doesn't really want to think about that. He's very indulgent. And, you know, I've heard some readers say they find Abdullah completely unsympathetic, that he's just too arrogant. But I find him a product of his culture, and I have a great deal of sympathy for him because he is caught between cultures.
Mm-hmm.
He's part of this new wave of Saudi men who were educated in America and were incredibly smart and ambitious and created this incredible surge within their country towards modernization. And yet he comes from a tribal land and has these centuries of history behind his family, and his father had several wives. And so it's like, how do you reconcile those two worlds? And for me, he really is, much like Rosalie, he's caught in two different worlds. So it's people trying to find their footing and where they really belong. And I think the end result is that in this sort of modern day world, globalized world, it's nearly impossible to find a place you truly belong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really fascinating stuff. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Kaya Parson, and her new novel is The Ruins of Us, published by Harper Perennial. And I must say, I'm happy that this, and I don't know if you are, I'd like to hear from you, but I like that this is a trade paperback original, and I like that more and more novels are paperback originals, because sometimes I think, especially with new first-time authors, first-time novelists, you know, putting out $25-$26 for a hardback can be daunting. And and yet I know there, you know, some writers only want that. What do you think? Mm-hmm. How do you feel about it?
That's a really good question and a really interesting one. I think you're absolutely right that for me as a debut writer, I am grateful for the fact that people, you know, can buy this in a bookstore for $14.99, and it's more like pocket change as opposed to the investment of a, you know, $25-$26 hardcover. So they may be more willing to take a chance on a name that they don't know. So I think it really is a good thing for my long-term career, even if, you know, let's say my second novel does come out in hardcover, by that point, you know, hopefully I will have some sort of a base of people who then will be able to say, okay, yes, she's a known quantity. We will be willing to invest this in her second book. So I do think it's a shrewd move on the part of the publishing industry, and definitely Harper Perennial has their brand that they very carefully guard, and have created this image of sort of slightly edgier books, and they really are on the cutting edge of new media advertising. They do a lot of work with book blogs and Facebook advertising, so I feel like I've been in really good hands in that regard. Of course, the writer in me, who just loves to pick up a beautiful hardcover that has that nice grainy cover and, you know, is just so beautiful on the shelf, also would like to one day see my book in hardcover, mm-hmm. but I can definitely wait and just feel a deep sense of gratitude to be able to hold my book at all.
So. Yeah, I think it's wise. Like you said, you know, first time novelist, but, you know, and I can see where, you know, you have your readership and then the second book is hardcover. And, of course, then your readers, you have your reader base and on and on. This would be a wonderful time to hear you read to us from The Ruins of Us. Would you do that?
Absolutely. I'll just do a little intro on the piece that I'll read. So Rosalie has just asked her maid, her housemaid, to point out which house on her block belongs to the second wife, whose name is Isra. And so now she has this information, which perhaps she doesn't really need for peace of mind, but she's thinking, she's just trying to process it. Overwhelmed, she put her head down on the cool marble countertop, letting her back sway out behind her. She felt a vein in her forehead throb against the pink veins of the marble. Through it, she could feel the slab from which the stone came, and through that, the entire quarry, and even faintly the pulse of the sea beneath the boat that brought it over from Italy. She felt small, her connectivity tenuous. Resting there, she tried to forestall the building agitation and gather the stillness. Another beat passed. She took up the vegetable knife that lay by the sink. Then she strode to the front door. Once past the door, she walked to the end of the driveway, under the magnificent wooden gate that Abdullah had taken from a centuries-old coral house that developers had raised in Jeddah. She took a left at the road, walking briskly, as if she were going to ask for butter or milk. The sharp Bermuda grass along the roadside poked through her sandals. She marched in time with the steady tick of the sprinklers that lined the planting area in the middle of the street. She thought, I am doing. I do. The movement felt good, the purpose of one foot going in front of the other. She stopped in front of Isra's house. Feeling faintly queasy, she pushed the gate open. It groaned on its oversized hinges. She clenched her fist around the vegetable knife, which had grown swift with sweat. She checked the windows and the garden's layout. An overgrown fig tree shadowed the driveway, creating darkening gibbous places into which she could slip unnoticed. She stole through the shadows until she was at the tree's base. She stopped for a moment and stood in the tree's deep shade. Then she plucked a fig from the lowest branch. It was not fig season, so the fruit was withered, folded in on itself. White-knuckled, using the vegetable knife, she cut a large, thin X across the fruit's wrinkled belly. She stuck the knife through it and walked to the front door, where she left the fig on the bamboo welcome mat. She turned and started to jog down the driveway. Just as she reached the small wooden gate, a voice called out, "Rosalie, is that you?" "So she knows my face," Rosalie thought. "All this time, and she's known my foolish, ignorant face." Then, remembering advice her father had given her when they were vacationing in Yellowstone, "If you don't move, it can't see you," she stood still, panic starting its slow climb up from her stomach in all languages. Shit. Hada. Nerd. "Rosalie, is everything all right? Would you like some of my figs? They're not in season now, but when they are, they just fall to the ground and rot. I've no one to eat them. Abdullah hates..." Isra's voice trailed off, as if she knew she shouldn't have mentioned his name. Slowly, Rosalie turned her head, then her shoulders, her hips, her feet, until finally she faced Isra. She pulled up her best beauty queen smile. "Hello." "How are you doing?" Isra asked, her head tilted in that warm way that some women had. "The bitch speaks perfect English," she thought. She'd heard from Miriam that Israel was well-educated, that she spoke four languages and had been an interpreter for Arafat when she was a student. In another life, Israel would be a woman Rosalie admired. She took a few steps back toward the driveway, wishing she hadn't left the knife stuck in the fruit, evidence that proved her insanity beyond reasonable doubt.
Thank you so much. That was Kaya Parson, and reading from The Ruins of Us, published by Harper Perennial. Talk a little bit about the structure of the book. It's a multiple point of view novel, and I particularly like multiple point of view novels, especially when you do need to or want to go into various characters' heads and kind of get a first, you know, upfront front seat view on what's going on with them. But talk about how you decided that to do that.
Sure, absolutely. I, too, love multiple point of view novels, particularly as I was writing this book and teaching myself how to write in multiple points of view. I read The Poisonwood Bible, and I adored that book. And I also found that Barbara Kingsolver was able to do so much more by going into the heads of the characters that she chose. There was an elasticity to the multiple points of view that I thought was really interesting and a really wise choice on the part of the writer. And it just seemed to come very naturally to this story, especially because I didn't want to just tell the story from an American point of view. It might have been audacious to do so, but I felt the need to tell some of the points of, some of the story from a Saudi point of view, and so to inhabit both Faisal, the son's consciousness, and also Abdullah's, because if I didn't make that choice to go into their heads, it would be too easy to demonize them or write them off or characterize them, and so I felt that it would allow me to tell a more subtle story, a more psychologically interesting story from the various points of view. And additionally, it allows, it's good for plot because it allows you to sort of unfold plot points in perfect time so that it kind of unfolds in a sort of mystery.
So in terms of that then, in terms of plot, how much did you know before you started out? Did you have any sort of synopsis written, or did you put a lot of time into thinking, you know, how the book would end? How did you do that?
I did not know how the book would end, and I really just knew that I wanted to explore the extremism that existed in Saudi Arabia. I had started writing the book in 2005, and I was living in New York City at the time. And, you know, when 9/11 had happened, I was just about an hour south of New York City. And so I felt it resonated with me very deeply. And, of course, with my family's connection to Saudi Arabia, it was just an event that I found so perplexing and, you know, saddening and infuriating, too. And so once I learned that 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, I really wanted to understand why. And so in Faisal's character, I explore that extremist mentality and just how, you know, who is essentially a good boy, a good Saudi boy, a good intelligent boy can go down that path. And the plot really developed very organically, I thought, through the tensions between Faisal and his mother. And then, of course, there were the tensions between Rosalie and Abdullah. And I just felt very fortunate that the way the plot kept unfolding seemed to fit the characters and their needs as well, and the needs of the story. So I can't say, unlike, you know, I've heard John Irving say that he can write the final sentence mm-hmm. of his book, mm-hmm. and when he starts out, and I'm definitely not that controlled as a writer. So, but I think there's a lot of pleasure to be had in just following the story where it wants to take you, and then once you're to the end of the draft, shaping it up and making it make sense.
Mm-hmm. This time with you has flown by. We should have booked an hour. But would you leave our listeners with any sorts of advice or any kind of tip that might help them along the way in their own writing lives?
Absolutely. I teach a workshop out here in Missouri, and the thing that I always tell my students, many of whom want to talk to me about publishing and how I've, got my book out there in the world, I just sort of remind them to slow down a little bit and really enjoy and relish process over product.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's advice that Frank Conroy, who was sort of the great director of the Iowa Writers Workshop for many, many years, would give his students. And I think it's so wise, because if you're in this, if the book is the end, and the writing is just the means to the end, I think you've sort of missed out on something, which is, the wonderful and wondrous writing process itself. And so to just relish that and make the book as the best book it can be, and then, then start to think about the business end of things. Because, frankly, the business end really does kill a lot of the wonderful pleasures of just the pure writing itself. So I think writers should really try to just be in the moment with their book and their writing, and not think that the book, a published book, is really the end towards which they're striving.
Mm. Yeah, wise advice. That's great. Yeah, it's too often those writers who are waiting or wanting the end result or wanting the book tour, they stop
right.
writing. Because
right.
it's too long a journey to do it for the end result. So thank you for that. And thanks so much for taking the time with us here on the show.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Kaija Parson, and her book is The Ruins of Us, published by Harper Perennial. And do check it out. It's a gem. And give it a chance. Give it a big, long chance, because it's wonderful. And takes you into the Saudi culture in a really new and interesting way. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, hopefully we will have Eric Weiner with us. So stay with us. Don't go anywhere.
That's life. That's what all the people say. Riding high in April, shot back down in May. But I know I'm gonna change that tune. When I'm back on top in June. I said that's life, and as funny as it may seem, some people get their kicks stomping on a dream. But I don't let it get me down. 'Cause this fine old world, it keeps spinning around. I've been a prophet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out. And I know one thing, each time I find myself flat on my face, I pick myself up and get back in the race. That's life. You know I can't deny it. I thought of quitting, baby, but my heart just ain't gonna buy it. And if I didn't think it was worth one single try, I'd jump right on a big bird, then I'd fly. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out, and I know one thing. Each time I find myself flat on my face, I pick myself up and get back in the race. try it. But my heart just ain't gonna quit, and it will not buy it. If I didn't think it was worth one single try, I'd jump on a big bird and then I'd fly. Yeah, that's life.
I lost my mojo.
You lost it?
I lost it.
Where'd it go?
I don't know, but I found it. I found it on Writers on Writing.
Writers on Writing?
Wednesday mornings at 9. 9 a.m. in the morning.
With Barbara DeMarco Barrett and Marie Stone?
That's them.
The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about the show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. You can find us on the web at KUCI.org and at iTunes. Go down to radio, find college, and KUCI FM is there. So wherever you are on the planet, you can listen to the show. This show will soon be podcasts. We've been having some trouble with our podcasts, as some of you know, and I'm hearing from some of you for past shows. And I don't know what happened, but we're reconstructing. So we have so many shows on our podcasts at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. And this one will go up there real soon as well, probably within the next week. So you can listen again if you missed something or you want to direct others to the show. And you can find more at penonfire.com in terms of Writer Salon events and so on. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we are back with Eric Weiner. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Geography of Bliss, which has been translated into 18 languages. A former correspondent for NPR and the New York Times, he's reported from more than 36 countries. His work has appeared in the New Republic, Slate, the LA Times, the Washington Post, Foreign Policy, the New York Times Magazine, and the anthology Best American Travel Writing. His website is ericweinerbooks.com, and he is here today to talk about Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine, and it was published by 12. Let's bring him on. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Barbara. Good to be here.
Thank you for coming on the show. Before I go into questions I have for you, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about how Man Seeks God came about.
Well, it came about partly in my head, in the sense that there was one statistic I had stumbled across when I was researching my previous book, The Geography of Bliss, and that is this, that religious people are happier than the secular, and that's pretty much true in every survey, and I wanted to know why. Was it because, as my atheist friends say, ignorance is bliss? Or is there something else going on, and do the religious know things that the rest of us don't? That was the sort of head-based part, but the, I guess you would say, heart-based motivation came about through a brief story, if I can relay that to you. I was, I all of a sudden experienced this sharp-shooting abdominal pain, and I don't like doctors, don't like hospitals, even less than most people, but my wife convinced me that I needed to go to the ER, and I did, and they found something wrong with me but what they couldn't say, and so I'm left in this examination room afraid, really scared that something's terribly wrong with me, and a nurse walks in, smells my fear, and whispers in my ear the following words, "Have you found your God yet?" And that was the question that I set out to answer in this book.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's interesting on many levels, and one of them is just how writers are propelled to pursue projects and what that thing is that propels them, you know, and it's interesting that, that was yours for this book.
Yeah, and I think every good book can essentially be boiled down to one or perhaps two questions. You know, what is the question you're trying to answer? And in this case, I was trying to find a faith that fit, something that fit me personally. And I realized that this was something that a lot of us are doing. I mean, something like 1 out of 3 Americans will change their religious affiliation over the course of a lifetime. And that's a huge number. So what I did in this book, sort of trying on 8 different religions, is just sort of a more intense, slightly speeded up version of what many people are doing anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about, I believe you talk about, or you say we're a spiritually promiscuous nation.
We are. We're a nation of God hoppers, or if you want to be consumeristic about it, God shoppers.
Mm-hmm.
And really, for the first time in human history, we have this amazing smorgasbord of religious and spiritual options to choose from, thousands, literally thousands. And this is both a wonderful thing, because choice is good, but it's also a not wonderful thing, because choice can paralyze, or as the French like to say, too much choice kills the choice, and it's easy to get lost in this jungle of possibilities.
Mm-hmm. You were on the show for The Geography of Bliss, and mm-hmm. this book, Man Seeks God, it's interesting because they're entirely different books, but it's also, this one's also about a journey, and the structure is similar too, in that you're traveling around, you know, you're like you said, you're trying on different religions, you're kind of doing personal mm-hmm. research here. Talk about that. I mean, was it your intention to do a similar structure, or did you find yourself just doing it, and that was how the book was evolving?
Well, I found myself doing it, that is, traveling, because it's just kind of in my nature, Barbara. I can't sit still, and I tend to just automatically think geographically. And so if I'm going to explore, say, Buddhism, which I do in this book, where am I going to do it? Now, I could do it probably down the road from me. I'm sure there's a Buddhist temple or a meditation center, and in some chapters I did go down the road. But I find it useful to go far away and to sort of disorient myself, because I think ultimately that's what travel is all about. We disorient ourselves so that we can find new bearings. And as a writer and as a person, I find it helpful to be disoriented, and going to a place like Kathmandu or Istanbul or even Las Vegas, all of which I did in this book, I find very useful.
Hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting. I also like very much how you're on the page, and it's not so much kind of appraising different religions and where do you fit, but you're very much dealing with your attractions and your misgivings and your confusion. I love that about this book, and I would love our listeners to hear you read from it. Will you do that?
I would be glad to do that. So should I set the scene?
Yeah, please.
Okay, I am in the South Bronx in New York City, and I'm hanging out with Franciscan friars. Now, I like the Franciscans a lot. You know, they are, they really walk the walk. They dress like they just popped out of 13th century Umbria, which they in many ways have, and that they follow the traditions of St. Francis. But they're living in this really tough neighborhood in the South Bronx, so they're also very street smart. So I would not leave the friary where I was living with them without a friar in tow, because they were sort of my protection. So I'll read a brief section there. I've grown tired of shelter cuisine. I should stop by saying they run a homeless shelter. I want to go out to dinner, but I'm intimidated by the South Bronx at night, so invite two of the friars to join me. They are my protection. I recruit brothers Angelo and Joseph. They don't put up much resistance. I suspect they're looking forward to a change of pace. We make it only one block before encountering Jose. Jose is excited. Jose is agitated. Jose is drunk. He's a friendly drunk, but I sense the energy could pivot on a dime into something more ominous. I step back a few feet and let the brothers take the lead. They listen, for Jose has something very important to say. Oh boy, it is so important, but he can't quite get it out, owing to his inebriation. Jose glares at me. He senses my impatience. I know this because he says, "You're impatient, man." No, Jose, I'm not. I'm just hungry, which is true. The brothers, though, are the pinnacle of patience. They stand there and listen to Jose while I slip down the hill and wait for them. Finally, Jose moves on, and the friars join me. "How did you do it?" I asked. We told them it would be rude to keep our friend waiting. That was wise. They appealed to Jose's noble sense, allowed him to lift himself a bit higher. I learned my lesson, though. Never travel with a friar if you're in a hurry. Another lesson, never turn to friars for dining advice. They don't have a clue. They eat out only rarely and have, after all, taken a vow of poverty. They are not foodies. We wander aimlessly as the streets grow dark and finally settle on a Mexican restaurant that, though two blocks from the friary, comes as a revelation to them. It's a nice place, the real thing. The neighborhood has been steadily improving in recent years. If it gets much better, the friars may have to move to someplace worse, where they are needed more. They engage in a sort of reverse urban flight, always staying one step ahead of niceness. We sit down, and over the guacamole and chips, they say grace, blessing not only the avocado, but me, their benefactor. Once again, I like the way they say this sincerely, not by rote. But I have ulterior motives, as I often do. I still don't know how to help. I still think of myself in the third person. Eric is helping the needy. Eric is a regular Mother Teresa. What is the right frame of mind? I still don't get it. And we went on to sit down over our guacamole and chips, and they explained to me the importance of motivation and doing good for others, not to feel, you know, just good about yourself and to pat yourself on the back, but as they see it, as doing God's work, which I find interesting because while all religions do preach altruism, it's almost always with a sort of multiplier effect in the sense that it's not just about helping another person. It's about, well, what the Jews call tikkun ha'olam, or repairing the world, or doing the work of Jesus and God, as the Christians would say. But it's almost always larger than that actual act.
Yeah, that's great. That's great stuff. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is Eric Weiner. His book is Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. Were there any surprises along the way? I mean, did you?
Oh my God! Nothing but surprises, really.
How about a couple, or maybe a major surprise? Something you just did not expect in when you started writing the book.
I guess. I'll dive in and say I did not expect that I would like Judaism, for instance. Even though I was born nominally Jewish, raised nominally Jewish, I really wanted to sort of get that chapter over with because it was a little too close to the bone, and I was frankly more interested in the more exotic faiths, Buddhism and Taoism, for instance. That was one surprise. Other surprises, I was sort of surprised at how little the sort of creation myths or creation stories, depending on your perspective, mattered to the religious people I encountered along the way. They were sort of very practical. They really looked at their religions as kind of an applied philosophy. You know, how can it help them get through the day a bit wiser and a bit happier? That surprised me. Also, I was surprised by really how welcoming people were to me. I mean, here I was, this sort of, you know, gastronomical Jew on this sort of crazy spiritual quest taking me around the world, and people opened their doors, temple doors and their home doors and all kinds of doors. And I think it just goes to show that if people sense that you are serious about this sort of search, that they will open themselves to you.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. I was curious, too, because you have a journalism background, I was curious how you parcel out ideas, how you've decided, this is an article or maybe this is a book. How does that happen for you?
I mean, I like big ideas. My first book was about happiness. My second book was about God, which is arguably bigger than happiness. So I mean, I like big ideas. I know people have written entire books on the toothpick, 500 pages, I believe, on the toothpick. and that is wonderful, but that's not for me. I'm drawn to two things. I'm drawn to ideas, and I'm drawn to places and how the two intersect and play off of one another. And so, for some writers, when they come up with an idea, their first response might be, okay, that's a great idea about X. What should I read? What should I do? But my first reaction is always, where should I go? And from there, other ideas flow. But I sort of need to get on a plane and go somewhere. But at the same time, I think that the problem with a lot of travel writing is that it is just travel, kind of meandering through Algeria or wherever, and there isn't always a bigger point. And I think that, if travel writing is going to survive and thrive, and I hope it will, it needs to be this sort of travelogue of ideas where there's something at stake and where the writer has something at stake.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about writing yourself out of a tough place? I mean, my sense of you is that you have an ease with words and that words come easy to you. I certainly don't know if that's true or not, but have you reached places with this project where you just don't know what's coming next and you're just in a sort of in a corner? And if so, then what? And if not, what would you suggest when writers get to that point?
Words don't come easily to me the first time, more like the seventh or eighth or ninth time. It's the revising process, of course. Of course you get stuck, or you fear that you're treading on cliched ground or problems like that. I try to. I've always been of the belief that the difference between good writing and bad writing is not, the sort of calisthenics you do with words, but the degree of honesty. And so if I am stuck, which happens fairly often, I just stop and say, okay, Eric, can you be more honest here about what's going on? And if I do that and sort of peel that onion back enough times, I find that makes a big difference. And you can almost always do that, even if you're stuck in a corner when you're writing, and you don't know where things are going. Just stop yourself and say, okay, be honest. And maybe that honesty means saying, I'm stuck, and you write about being stuck in some way.
Well, that's interesting because, like you said a moment ago, when you feel that you're treading on cliched ground, I think you said, I suppose when you fear that, especially if you're maybe dealing with a subject that has been covered a million times, or talking about a place that's been written about a million times, to somehow get to that honest place of what you truly think or feel.
And that's tricky because, let's face it, this is, I believe, not the first book to be written about God and religion. Few others came before, and when it comes to the travel element, I mean, there's virtually nowhere on the planet that hasn't been written about before. So, all we bring to the table is, that mercurial thing called voice or perspective or whatever you want to call it. And And sometimes I think because we consume so much media, you know, consciously and subconsciously, that it's hard not to be cliched, and sometimes we don't even realize that the ideas we have are not our own, and we need to take a step back or two and look at this city or this religion or whatever it is with fresh eyes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I sure do.
And so I think the danger is not the sort of obvious cliches, because I think we can identify those, but the less obvious ones, thoughts that we think are our own, but in fact are not. We just, you know, read them that morning or heard them on the radio.
Sometimes, and I don't know what you do to see things clearer, but I know, you know, I always ask my students, did you read this aloud? Did you let it sit for a week or two or three and then read it aloud and see what you thought? Because you bring a different perspective to it. How do you bring a different perspective to your writing? Do you let it sit for a while?
I love to read aloud, and I think because of my radio background at NPR, I very much write for the ear, and I think that's good. I think, you know, readers tell me that they can hear my voice literally when reading my book, and I take that as a very high compliment. So I think reading one's work aloud, at least for me, is hugely helpful. And, yeah, if you can, if you have that luxury of putting the work aside for a few weeks, assuming you're not going to blow through a deadline by doing that, that can be very helpful, because then you have some distance from it. And sometimes it can be simply you read it back to yourself after 3 weeks have passed, and you're pleasantly surprised at how good it is. It's like reading someone else. And other times you read it and you go, oh my God, that is just awful. I can't believe I used that verb there. I've got to take that out. And it almost always helps.
Mm-hmm. We are at the end of our time. Would you offer any sort of advice or tips for the writers who are listening?
At the risk of sounding redundantly repetitive, I would go back and say the honesty thing. Take a piece of writing, something you've written, put it down for an hour or a day, come back to it and say, is this honest? And could I be more honest here in this point? Even if being honest is embarrassing, humiliating, whatever, can I be more honest?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, That's a big one, and that's a good one.
Yeah.
I appreciate you taking the time again, Eric. Thank you so much, and I'll be curious what you come up with next.
Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Barbara.
That was Eric Weiner. His book is Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine, published by 12. And we are at the end of the show. Again, it went so fast. It always goes fast when you have good guests. And I'm going to leave you now. You can visit penonfire.com for more info on the show or on the blog. And we do accept emails from you if you want to be on the e-list so that we can, we'll tell you the day before usually if I remember to send it out. Who's coming on? And also there's a link to the blog there. You can listen to past shows, especially when we get them all back up. There'll be hundreds upon hundreds. Now there's maybe 100. So until next time, thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm going to close with the late, great Etta James.